Part 1. Prologue. To die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Walt Whitman. It used to be the custom of Zen masters on their deathbeds to compose a gatha, a poetic condensation of the insights of a long and dedicated spiritual life, a final comment on life itself and impending death. This essay is my concluding gatha, or rather, it would be if I were a Zen master, or at least a Zen man, and I had obviously come to the very end of my life and I were writing in verse. All the same, the composition of something like a secular and prose gatha at this time strikes me as not just a useful exercise, a sorting out and taking stock and overall clarification, but a project that's necessary for my own sake, if for no others, and very urgent, and in fact long overdue. For already at 79, I have lived 2 or even 3 times as long as people did on the average not so many centuries ago. And of course every new day spent in death row, waiting for the sentence to be carried out, brings that much nearer the moment when I will finally be whisked out of life, perhaps with no warning at all. Into what? Is there a more pressing, more crucial question? It seems to me silly, contemptibly ostrich-like, and altogether irresponsible not to prepare for that moment of truth by asking myself now, and now, and now, while the asking is good and I'm not ill or in pain or drugged or pushed for time, such questions as, exactly what is it to live and then to die? Must I in fact die at all? And, if I must, is this indeed a dead end, the great letdown, the bitter and messy conclusion of the adventure that began so promisingly way back in 1909? And above all, is it possible to do something right now, first to ensure survival, and second to influence its quality and ensure that it's worthwhile and preferable to annihilation? Going into these questions as candidly and comprehensively as possible is just about the most practical endeavour of my whole life. Even if no one else were to read my pseudo-gatha, it demands to be written, clearly and honestly. I've got to do my utmost to be honest with myself. On this, of all subjects, any suppression of unwelcome evidence, any cheating would make the whole project a ridiculous waste of time. I could call it my own highly personal and demythologized Book of the Dead. Not remotely Egyptian or Tibetan, of course, or even religious in any ordinary sense, but frankly contemporary and Western and matter of fact. For I aim to conduct this inquiry in a spirit that values the most threadbare shred of present evidence, the faintest glimmer of first-hand experience, the least impulse of humility in the face of the given, more highly than libraries full of scriptures and learned commentaries. Here, nothing, however uplifting and sacred, is for believing. Everything, however mundane, is for trying out and testing. In this life-or-death matter, I can afford to take no teaching on trust, to rely on no one's say-so, and to neglect no clue. Here at death's door, if nowhere else, I find myself forced to follow the dying Buddha's advice and be a lamp to myself, to take myself to no outside refuge. This cautious, disrespectful attitude to the religious establishment, to all hallowed authority, is made even more necessary now that, as I shall presently show in some detail, important new empirical evidence on our subject is available. This evidence is of 3 sorts. The first arises from the skills and the skeptical and far-ranging attitude of modern science, together with some of its actual discoveries, particularly in particle physics. The second arises from recent research into the anecdotes of patients who have been brought back from near death. The third rises from a range of simple experiments I have been using over the past 30 years for investigating our intrinsic nature, or first personhood. Techniques for directly perceiving who or what it is here that is conducting these experiments. Who or what it is that lives and dies. Who or what it is that does nothing of the sort. A selection of these experiments constitutes the backbone of this book, and, when carried out and not just read about, cannot fail to settle the question of one's nature and destiny. These three developments, and especially the last, demand that the whole subject be opened out freshly, and that we should start from scratch with as unprejudiced a mind as possible. Our current resistance to such an investigation, to any candor or realism concerning our own mortality, can scarcely be exaggerated. Witness the popular cult of youth at all costs in the worlds of advertising and fashion. Witness those communities of old folk dedicated to being as young as you feel, and to avoiding all reminders of old age, sickness, and death. Witness the newspeak and double talk of 70 years young in place of 70 years old, and elderly person or senior citizen in place of old man, old woman. Witness the funerary nonsense so tellingly described in Evelyn Waugh's The Loved One. Witness cryonics, the freezing of the newly dead for revival when technology is further developed, thus giving effect to the view that death is an imposition on the human race and no longer acceptable. Witness the cultists who seriously maintain that death is unnecessary and unnatural, and we can choose to live as long as we wish. How unlike the veneration of old age and the preoccupation with death and the hereafter which are such marked features of some great cultures. And again, what a contrast with the memento mori, remember you must die, of earlier centuries of our own civilization. Its human skulls carved on tombstones and displayed on mantelpieces, its countless engravings and paintings confronting the living with the grim spectacle of Death the Reaper and the imagined sequel. Were our ancestors just morbid? Rather, it is we, with our pathetic Nelson's eye for the least escapable fact of our life, its end, who are morbid. Only in part is our willful blindness offset, at a less popular level, by modern depth psychology. For instance, by the view that there is just one real but well-concealed terror, the fear of death, from which our many conscious fears all derive. The lesson for me is plain. Attack fear at its root. Test the bold claim of the Sufi master Attar. The only remedy for death and the fear it generates is to look it constantly in the face. And for sure we don't lack our very own uniquely powerful memento mori, namely our all too justified anxiety about the possibility or probability of nuclear war, followed by a nuclear winter, the species' mass suicide. We are all being forced to admit that we live precariously in the valley of the shadow of death. However, the death that comes to you and me anyway, sooner or later, is never experienced as a mass event, but only by this solitary one. I mean, by the first person singular, present tense, and never by second or third persons as such. In short, by oneself, alone with oneself. Inevitably, my death, and this preview of it, is the most personal and private adventure imaginable. And of course, just because of this unique and inescapable intimacy, it is universal, everyone's adventure. Which is why I'm inviting you, my reader, to join me now in this inquiry. Before we make a start, let's conclude these preliminary observations with a warning and a promise from a famous Buddhist text, the Dharmapada. Vigilance is the path of immortality, heedlessness the path to death. The vigilant do not die, but the heedless are already like the dead. This assertion, though it proves nothing at all, should encourage us to give to this matter all the care, truthfulness, open-mindedness, and attention of which we are capable.